Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University in our Ames studio joining us today. Great to have you on board, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Dennis Goldford with us as well of Drake University, where he's professor and chair of political science at Drake University in Des Moines. Hi, Dennis.
Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you and to our listeners. We love to have, of course, on Wednesdays, our audience of political junkies and others. You can join our conversation this hour. We're going to be talking a little bit later about the president's desire to have a grand military parade in Washington. What are your thoughts on that? Also, perhaps you were involved in Monday's caucuses. You might want to tell us about your experience there. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Well, top of the news was this evidently this agreement, a bipartisan agreement in the Senate on a two-year budget deal, adding billions of dollars to federal spending there. But really, the audio of the week is claimed by the president in terms of the one that stands out the most. Yesterday, he said he supports a government shutdown if Democrats won't agree to tighten immigration laws.
Frankly, I'll go a step further. If we don't change the legislation, if we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13, there are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of. So we have to strengthen our borders, not by a little bit, but by a lot. We are so far behind the time. And by the way, the world is laughing at us because they can't believe these policies. They don't have it. I could name 15 of them right now. No other country in the world has what we have. And we're going to get it stopped. And if we have to shut it down because the Democrats don't want safety, and unrelated but still related, they don't want to take care of our military, then shut it down. We'll go with another shutdown.
Okay. Contrast that strident view of the president yesterday with the fact that negotiators in Congress were close to a major budget deal. We heard about the top of the hour news of this deal in the Senate. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. He met with Leader Mitch McConnell, the GOP leader in the Senate, yesterday to discuss these negotiations. Here is Senator Schumer talking yesterday about the meeting.
I'm very pleased to report my meeting with Leader McConnell went very well. We're making real progress on a spending deal that would increase the caps for both military and middle-class priorities on the domestic side that Democrats have been fighting for, and my colleagues will explain some of them shortly. Because just as our men and women in uniform deserve the resources they need to keep our country safe, so do our veterans waiting for better health care. So do our young people seeking treatment for opioid addiction. So do families living in rural communities waiting for high-speed internet to connect them to the world, and so many other priorities.
Okay. Chuck Schumer, what are you making, gentlemen, of this latest dance, this all-too-familiar dance by Congress to find funding for the government and the president's voice in this? Dennis Goldford, it seems almost as if the president is representing a third party up there, doesn't it?
Well, we have to remember that while the Republicans have pretty much signed on with President Trump, there are not many John McCain's or Bob Corker's or Jeff Flake's out there at the moment. Originally, Donald Trump was a kind of hostile takeover of the Republican Party. And Trump likes to be a free agent to maneuver for, in his phrase, the best deal he can possibly get, which may be a version of what Bill Clinton used to call triangulating 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago, when he'd sort of play a different role or take a different position from congressional Democrats in dealing with congressional Republicans. So this is pretty much of a negotiating position. The thing that strikes me, of course, is that we're a long way from the talk in the president's State of the Union address about unity and bipartisanship, at least on the part of the president. Not when, of course, you get, as opposed to teleprompter Trump, you get Twitter Trump out on the campaign trail, where he basically said that anybody on the Democratic side that didn't clap for him was guilty of treason. So we're a long way from that focus on bipartisanship and unity. But when it comes down to it, the government has got to get funded so that it can operate, whether it's the military or domestic matters.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the House, headwinds there, Dave, before we do get a budget agreement, right?
Sure. The House is certainly going to try a much more conservative line on this. But I think there's two really important things that just happened today. First, the Senate seems to practice something called bipartisanship, and not just bipartisanship.
What's that word? Repeat it.
But I forget. It's been so long since I've used it, it's hard to even utter it. But not just bipartisanship, but this looks to be a long-term deal, a two-year budget. That's amazing. We haven't gone beyond about a four-month budget in I don't know how many years. It's really astounding to see the Senate so quickly come together and deal with some major issues all at once, not just the budget, but the agreement also seems to include a hike in the debt ceiling, which would take that nasty debate off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is kind of remarkable to see the Senate move forward like this. The other big thing is I feel like President Trump just came into his own and started acting like his own independent president to a much greater degree. In the previous year, where I think our federal government notably had one accomplishment in the tax reform bill, it sounded like President Trump was largely allowing congressional Republicans to lead in the policy formation, and he just agreed to sign off on it, and he kind of went off and talked about whatever he wanted to talk about. But here, President Trump sounds like he's taking leadership and saying exactly what he wants in a bill, and quite impressively seems to be going in a route that nobody's likely to follow.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this as well, Dennis, as a new tact by the president?
Well, I'm skeptical of every time people talk about a new Trump. We've seen that quite often ever since the campaign. So I wouldn't go too far with it. But I think Dave's right to the extent that the immigration issue, the wall, was perhaps President Trump's signature issue. And he didn't really know or care much about tax policy. He has very little public policy knowledge or background or really interest on a lot of different things, which is why Republicans hoped he'd simply sit up there and sign whatever bill they sent him. So it was more of a Republican agenda in the sense of establishment congressional Republicans than it is a Trump agenda. But this is a Trump agenda. And the question, of course, is how far he's willing to go to the edge, to play brinksmanship. When he says shut it down, that we have to start off seeing that as a negotiating position. The question is whether it becomes an actual option.
Mm-hmm. So where are we with the immigration debate? That played such a big role, especially for the Democrats trying to get action on the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And interestingly, also yesterday, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly quoted as suggesting that some immigrants eligible for DACA failed to apply for legal protections because they were too afraid, or in his words, too lazy to get off their asses. And he said he found it stunning and unexpected that Trump, this was last month, offered to provide a pathway to citizenship for the DACA recipients. Dave, where are we with DACA? Is that part of this budget agreement that we are learning details of, as far as you can see?
I don't think DACA is a part of this. I think, though I'm not sure of this, that DACA is going to be held separate, as well as the entire immigration debate, so that the Senate and the House can talk about these issues by themselves without entangling them with the budget or the debt deal. And frankly, that seems like a smart way to go forward with such a difficult issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to military parades. In our news since yesterday, White House confirming that President Trump has ordered the Pentagon to look into staging a grand military parade for our nation's capital, reporting evidently saying that the president was inspired by Bastille Day, the parade he saw when he was in Paris last summer. Dennis, what are your thoughts on this move by the president and why presidents, we don't strut our stuff in the same way that some other countries do in the world?
Frankly, I'm a little disturbed by it. You know, we all have our tics, particularly those of us who speak publicly, but everybody has a particular tic. I noticed very much during the campaign at particular rallies when President, then candidate Trump, was being covered by live television broadcast and cable and the like, that if you'll notice, even at the State of the Union address, he will walk out in front of a crowd and while everybody's applauding, he will clap as well. He will applaud as well. So he's continued that as president. And at the time, I thought, the only time I've really noticed a world leader doing it, now maybe they have and nobody's covered them, but the only time I've noticed world leaders doing that is in old footage of Soviet and Chinese and North Korean leaders. In other words, people we consider to be autocrats or dictators or whatever, they would stand and applaud themselves in a way or applaud the audience applauding them. Likewise, they're the folks who would stage these grandiose military parades. And they'd have all sorts of equipment going through a large square, whether it's Red Square in Moscow or whatever the square is called in North Korea, in Pyongyang. And the leader would stand there applauding the military passing for review below him. And that's what I thought of, not Bastille Day in France, but that's what I thought of when I heard about this plan for a great military parade. Now, of course, the Trump base is extremely patriotic. You could argue all Americans are extremely patriotic, but they have a special connection, they believe, to the military. And the president may believe he can score some points with his base, again, because he plays to his base all the time, by featuring, highlighting himself praising the military. So he benefits from that as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear from you, Dave, in just a moment, but sure. Let's quickly go to our phones. Bruce is joining us on this topic from Iowa City. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I see this. I mean, I just heard about this just now on the news, and I was very disturbed to hear it, primarily because I've been reading about in the New York Times, for example, that with in Iraq, we not talking about Iraq, we confronted a regime that we claimed that we were confronting a regime as we led up to war that had regional ambitions, that hid weapons of mass destruction, that provided support for terrorists, and it led to the worst mistake this country's ever made, I think, in terms of both foreign policy and going to war. I won't go into the details. You understand what's going on in the Middle East right now. And Trump's really repeated the same line of reasoning with respect to Iran. Nikki Haley spoke about it in the UN just very recently or about a month ago about undeniable evidence that Iran wasn't keeping its promises for the Security Council resolution. So I see that all together. And now this sort of bringing out the military in this kind of parade fashion, I think it shows an extremely dangerous tendency and a potential lead up to war with Iran. And I just am so frightened of that possibility.
Okay, Bruce,
it would be disastrous.
Bruce in Iowa City, thank you for your thoughts. Dave, jump in here with your thoughts.
Well, I would like to echo Bruce. I think he's dead on with this. And that it's a matter of nuance here to me. It's that the United States has always supported its military and its troops, but the way we do it is rather important. We have a history of supporting our national defense. But that means that we have military parades when our troops have successfully completed a mission, we've won a war, we return our troops home, and we give victory parades, and we thank our troops for their service. Mm-hmm. We don't proactively march our military to show our military might, which feels much more imperialistic, like we are showing them off before we send them out to war, glorifying going to war rather than ending war. And it's a very small thing, but it is very important to the people, I think, who really pay attention to the military.
There's a lot of speculation going on what type of parade. I mean, we have the images that you've voiced, the displays of military prowess from Cold War era adversaries. But, I mean, couldn't we conceive of a military parade that would have a different tone, that would be not in that vein? Dennis, would that you know, sort of lessen your potential criticism there?
Well, you know, I remember as a child going to a military parade in which my father marched. My father was the World War II generation, and he was in the reserves for years after that. And I certainly remember that sort of parade. But for the most part, our parades, our military parades, have tended to be in celebration of the conclusion, the successful conclusion we like to hope, of a particular engagement or battle or war or something like that. And I think that, yeah, if it's simply a matter of troops marching, okay, although the question would be, what's the president doing during this? But, you know, some of what I've heard, and this, of course, is a brand new story, is that he really likes tanks. So are we going to see military equipment at the same time? That's where we find the similarities with parades we've seen among our adversaries mm-hmm. over the decades. And you have to remember, while we absolutely need a strong military and a national defense, remember the founding fathers were very concerned about the existence of a standing army. And we didn't have one for the longest time, really until after World War II, even though the numbers shrank. It's really only been since World War II, if I remember correctly, that we've had an actual kind of permanent standing army. Everybody disbanded after World War I, after the Spanish-American War, after the Civil War, and so forth. And the founding fathers were very concerned about the existence of standing armies. So again, the question is this to honor the military, or is this to use the military in some way to vouch for the president, to aggrandize the president's interests? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go quickly to Danielle in Woodward. We're got a whole list of other things to get to, but we want to squeeze in Danielle here. Welcome to our program, Danielle. Your thoughts on this particular issue, the military parades.
I agree with Dennis. Having grown up with historians and being married to an anthropologist, that really smacks of authoritarianism and a dictator-type personality. My question is, do you think this is masking a deep insecurity that Trump has regarding his right to be where he is? He's wiping out a lot of Obama-era progressive changes, and I think he's extremely insecure.
Mm. Okay, Danielle and Woodward, I don't know if our panel is has the psychological credentials to do this. Any Dennis, Dave, want to tackle that?
Well, I, as someone who's actually has a degree in psychology and has worked in the psych field,
well, very good.
I would not offer to suggest I can kind of look into the president's heart and mind, but I would say that a lot of reports do say that the president is very insecure in a lot of the things he's doing in the presidency, and that he is seeking constantly to return to his base, to return to the crowds that scream and cheer for him, return to those lines that get him lots of applause, kind of regardless of whether these are good ideas. And one thing that I think every president learns is that the country always rallies around the military. Anytime you talk about the military, you get loud applause, you get lots of cheers. Everyone in the country supports the idea of the military and supporting our troops. And I think it has become a go-to topic for the president, that he gets very little pushback when he glorifies the military. And I think that may lead him at times to get excessive in it.
In presidential studies, this is known as a part of the element we call wrapping yourself in the flag. Presidents like to wrap themselves in the flag, such that, as we saw with the State of the Union address, if you're attacking me, you're attacking the country. Mm-hmm. You're not just attacking me. Therefore, you're unpatriotic. And one of the ways to wrap yourself in the flag is to wrap yourself in the military. But I would just conclude that by saying, I believe it was 7-Up years ago. Ben, you're, I'm sure, able to remember this. I don't know if Dave can. There was a campaign in which I believe 7-Up was called the Un-Cola.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, you know, President Trump seems to want to be the un-Obama. In other words, if Obama said the sun comes up in the east, I think President Trump would want to prove that it comes up in the west. He wants to reverse and deny everything, whether good or bad, that President Obama did.
Mm. Speaking of wrapping yourself in the military, how about wrapping yourself in Wall Street Mondays and the consequences of that? The president has really taken every opportunity during his first year to wrap himself in the great news from the stock market. But then there was Monday's record-setting 1,175-point drop in the Dow Jones average. That's the largest single-day point loss in history. Happened on the same day the president delivered a speech on taxes and the economy. I believe that was in Ohio. Now, we've had volatility throughout this week, up and down. President Trump weighing in on Twitter today, lamenting that recent reports of good news on the economy hadn't resulted in the stock market rising. He talked about the good old days when good news was reported and the stock market would go up. I don't know if that's actually so accurate, but I'm not a financial expert. Do presidents tend to tie their fortunes, why or why not, Dave, to the stock market as much as Donald Trump has?
Well, presidents' approval ratings are typically tied pretty closely to the fortunes of the economy overall, and the stock market is just a day-by-day indication of the health of the economy. Whether it's accurate or not, people usually associate a rising stock market with good economic times and a dropping stock market with bad economic times. And President Trump has done this repeatedly, as he's referred to the stock market as an indication of the greatness of his presidency, which comes with a lot of dangers. It's really good when the stock market rises for an entire year like it did last year, but it's the stock market. Inevitably, it is going to crash again, and likely for nothing that President Trump has done or not done. It is just the market economy and the way the economy works. And by tying his fortunes so clearly to it, he puts himself at risk.
Mm-hmm. A quick question related from Frank, one of our listeners. What would it have been like if Obama had postponed the ACA and instead really focused on getting the economy going again? And once that was done, proposed the ACA. He has a few other parts of this, but we're coming up on a break. Dennis, I guess the idea here is that people are feeling better about the economy. We have to remember the beginning of the Obama presidency, we had 10% unemployment, facing an economic collapse. President Obama left with unemployment under 5%, if I remember.
Right. I think the stock market, the Dow, was down to around 8,000, something like that. It was pretty bad. A lot of criticism among more centrist Democrats, as well as others, was that the president should have focused more directly on the economy and waited for the ACA. And he took a lot of criticism for not doing that, for getting the ACA passed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're saying perhaps Donald Trump is a better salesperson for the economy, and that actually has real impact on the economy, perhaps?
Well, you know, I think John Maynard Keynes referred to what I believe he called it animal spirits or something, the sense of investors being bold and wanting to go out and help create wealth and so forth. And there's a strong psychological aspect to how well we think the country's doing, as well as a real objective aspect.
Okay, we will continue to ask Dennis and Dave to be bold in our second half hour with their analysis on this Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll talk about the Russia investigation, Trump's supposed eagerness to speak with the special counsel, Bob Mueller. His lawyers are reportedly telling him not to. Also, the Iowa caucuses happened this week without the spotlight we have in presidential election years. But it does matter. We'll find out why when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we are back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, one of my conversations will be with Roger Johnson. He's president of the National Farmers Union. He'll tell us about the challenges and concerns of the country's smaller scale farmers. The National Farmers Union has about 200,000 members, and I wouldn't doubt we have many of them listening to this program about politics today as well, with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, picking through some of the latest highlights, if we can call it that, on the political landscape. Would enjoy having you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, talking about the Iowa caucuses on Monday, despite that blanket of snow across the state. Many of the diehard political junkies out to make their presence felt. We'll talk about why the caucuses matter on non-presidential election years in a few minutes. But first of all, let's talk about some aspects developing in the ongoing Russia investigation. We have, I guess it's called Battle of the Memos, Dueling Memos. Now we have memos from the U.S. House investigation. Remember, there are three of them, one in the House, one in the Senate, and then we have the special counsel, Bob Mueller. Well, memos from the House investigation have become the focus of the committee's probe into the Russia meddling into the 2016 election. Yesterday, apparently, Donald Trump meeting with top Justice Department official to review a classified Democratic memo on the Russia investigation, coming a week after releasing a Republican account. Dennis, what is your view of what's been termed dueling memos?
Certainly on the Republican side, it's an attempt to allege that the FBI has not been functioning in a nonpartisan, neutral way, simply investigating leads where they go. They wanted to argue that the FBI is part of what has been called among the alt-right folks like Steve Bannon, the deep state, which they think is essentially partisan and democratic, and trying to undermine the legitimately elected president of the United States, Donald Trump. So that's the argument. In practical terms, what the memos were attempting to do is throw sand in the gears or throw sand in the eyes of the public. It's to create questions about the legitimacy of the not just the FISA warrants on Carter Page, who's very much of a secondary minor figure, but to suggest that whatever, unless it's a vindication of the president, they want to suggest that the Mueller investigation is, if not itself partisan, then it's been given a partisan tinge that it hasn't been able to wash out and therefore would be not legitimate in the minds of the president's supporters.
The president has until the end of the week to decide whether to make the Democratic memo public. Do we know already, Dave, what that rebuttal memo is likely to have in it?
It is probably to go point by point from the Republican memo and say, actually, that's not true. So they'll go point by point and say where, for instance, the Republican memo says the FISA warrant was based solely on the evidence of the Steele dossier and you can't trust the Steele dossier. The Democratic memo will say, well, that's not true at all. We know there are multiple other things used to get a FISA warrant. So that debunks claim one. And it's going to be a litany of these things. But I think what this whole debate really speaks to is the shift we've seen in Congress away from governing and to relentless campaigning. This is a campaign to discredit the Mueller investigation. But in no way is the release of these two memos helpful at all for the act of governing. The information in the Republican memo was trivial. Most of it was publicly known already. It certainly wasn't going to change anybody's mind. The real value to it is the value of a press release. It gave everybody a chance to talk about this more. And that's great during a campaign when you're trying to remain in the headlines. But right now, it would be really nice to see somebody work on governing.
Mm-hmm. But also, this latest development of the battle of the memos here has really, Dennis put it another way, but I mean, muddied the waters. In the minds of Americans, we look at polls. I don't have the data in front of me right now, but some believe this investigation is essential. Others believe that Donald Trump, as Donald Trump says, that it's a witch hunt. Given these two camps here, represented by national polls, Dennis, what do you see as this investigation enters what we think are its final stages?
We're entering, or we're already in dangerous times, I think, but we're going to increase the danger of the times in which we live. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the past and politics. Politics has always had its grubby aspects, but really, since the Gingrich-led Republican takeover of the House in 1994, excellent campaign. They beat a lot of sclerotic Democrats and a Democratic majority, so no issues there. But what's changed is that, in the words of the old theorist of war, Friedrich von Clausewitz, in Germany, in the 18th century, he said, "War is the continuation of politics by other means." But what we've had for the past 25, 30 years is that politics has become the continuation of war by other means. And as Dave said, there's less interested in governing than achieving partisan advantage and slapping down your opponents as treasonous and un-American, which you hear from the the Trump camp nowadays. So they're dangerous times.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what the New York Times reported this week. Lawyers for President Trump, as reported, have advised him against sitting down for a wide-ranging interview with the special counsel, Bob Mueller. Evidently, the lawyers concerned that the president, with his history of making false statements, contradicting himself, could be opening himself up to lying to investigators. What are, Dave, the president's options? What should be weighed when considering these options?
Well, the president can seek to kind of declare himself immune from having to testify under oath because of executive privilege. And that is doubtful. We really have no firm guidance on whether presidents can do this when they are personally under investigation or where their campaign or their close advisors are. But honestly, President Trump should seek to avoid testifying under oath at all costs, because if there is one dominant characteristic of President Trump, it's that he plays very fast and loose with the truth. He is not constrained by facts or consistency. And if you are inconsistent or tell a falsehood in front of a federal investigator, well, that's a crime. If you are not truthful under oath, that's a crime. And that can be an indictment right there. And for President Trump, a simple question like, was your inauguration crowd the largest ever, could get him into trouble, because it's a minor thing to misspeak about that and pretend that he did have the largest crowd ever when he didn't. But objectively, it's a lie, and that's lying to a federal investigator or to a grand jury. And that is a very dangerous place for a president to go.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your thoughts. Are we going to see a face-to-face with Mueller, between Mueller and the president, or a negotiation to deliver written answers to questions, or refuse, possibly be subpoenaed by Mueller and see how that ends up in the courts, possibly the Supreme Court?
The president has and his people have taken a very hostile, as we've seen, attitude toward this investigation, toward the Justice Department, toward the FBI. And the real question here is the question of impeachment. And by that, I don't mean, or I'm not referring to the Democrats talking about that all the time. The Democrats are failing to come up with their own particular program and argument. They just want to say we're against Trump, and that didn't do Hillary Clinton much good in 2016. But the question is whether there was anything the president would do in this regard that would cross a line for congressional Republicans, the way Nixon and the Watergate tapes crossed the line for congressional Republicans way back in 1974, when Barry Goldwater led a small delegation of the Republicans senators to the White House and said, "Mr. President Nixon, it's time for you to go." So far, the Republicans in Congress have been enablers of the president. And, you know, Speaker Ryan will say about something, well, that's unfortunate, even though he said, you know, particular comment years or months ago was the textbook definition of racism.
Right. With a few exceptions, we have to say, Corker
sure.
and McCain.
Well, I was just going to get there. The so-called never-Trumpers or anti-Trumpers among the Republicans have been making this argument for quite some time, but they're a minority. The majority of Republicans, again, find the president useful for advancing their particular agenda. So with dealing with the Mueller investigation, the question is, will the president feel free to block it, oppose it, refuse to participate in it as much as he wants without consequence? Or will there be some push from Republicans in Congress with power to threaten him to say, no, if you go this far, you've stepped over a line? We don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the caucuses, let's talk quickly about a Pennsylvania ruling. Evidently, Pennsylvania, the state must draw new maps. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to the state law GOP lawmakers' request to block that state's Supreme Court's January order that new congressional maps be drawn this year. So the U.S. Supreme Court staying out of it. Before the U.S. Supreme Court, I understand there's several gerrymandering cases before it. We're waiting for those that case and the decision on that in the months to come. Give us a sense of what this gerrymandering case means, the decision, the refusal by the U.S. Supreme Court to get involved here. This was a state's issue, so it was pretty easy for the U.S. Supreme Court to stay out, Dave?
I think it's not very easy for them to stay out. There is the Supreme Court usually will intervene when there are a lot of conflicting viewpoints on how to interpret the Constitution. And increasingly in the last 10 years, there has been a rising chorus of people asking for clarification about gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is the practice of just redrawing districts every 10 years after the census. And the court has already said that you cannot gerrymander for racial reasons. You can't use race as a factor to break up groups, to eliminate their voting power. And the argument that a lot of Democrats are using is that in 2010, Republicans won a bunch of state houses across the country, and they were able to use new technology to gerrymander to win on a partisan basis. And the question now is whether legislatures are allowed to do this. And some of the claims are that, well, if you go up to Wisconsin, the Republican Party won about 46% of the vote. That's not a majority. But they were able to hold 60% of the seats, giving them a supermajority, simply by the power of redistricting. And that lasts for a decade. And the Supreme Court now is hearing challenges all over the country that if they decide that a party cannot use their power within the legislature to gerrymander themselves into a permanent majority, if that gets rolled back, we're going to see a changing electoral landscape across the country.
I mean, look, you brought up the other example, Wisconsin. Here's Pennsylvania. The 2012 election results in Pennsylvania revealing the extent of gerrymandering. So Democratic candidates for that state's 18 U.S. House seats won 51% of the state's popular vote. But that translated to 5 of 18 seats. So a little more than one quarter of the state's House seats given to the Democrats, even though they had 51% of the popular vote. So that's a stark example, isn't it, Dennis?
Remember, though, that the House districts in states are won on a district basis, not a statewide basis, the way a governorship or a Senate would be. So how much vote you get is important, but where you get it is important as well. We saw that with the Electoral College. It's a similar sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But just to clarify, redistricting always occurs. Gerrymandering is a particular form of redistricting where you're trying to draw the districts in a way to maximize your own electoral chances and impair or minimize the opposing party's electoral chances. The problem for the court has always been that they claim that they don't have manageable standards by which to tell, well, does this gerrymandering go too far or not? And there's some folks who claim to have developed a certain statistical test to show that, in fact, the way a district is drawn has gone too far in that regard. At the hearings before the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice didn't seem overly impressed by that. But again, we'll have to see where this comes out.
Let's talk quickly about the caucuses, the midterm caucuses. Iowans gathering Monday night across the state. The midterm caucuses never well attended as the presidential caucuses. Republicans say they won't release any attendance numbers until later this month. Democrats say they don't have exact numbers, but attendance topped 9,000, much better, they say, than the last two midterm caucuses. Caucus site leader Ruth Thompson did her best to fire up a packed auditorium at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines.
We all have our work cut out for us this year, taking back the Iowa House and Senate, electing 4 Democrats to Congress, electing strong Democrats to all offices, from the courthouse to the state house, and of course, putting a Democrat back in the governor's office. To accomplish these goals, tonight's caucus is the first step in building a strong grassroots organization to kick off an unprecedented midterm election cycle. Having a successful caucus will show that Iowans are ready to stand behind the Democrats' progressive fight for Iowa's future.
Okay. Why do midterm caucuses matter here in Iowa, Dave?
I think you have to go to Dennis on that one.
Okay, Dennis. Well, got my D's mixed up. Okay, over to Dennis.
Oh, that's all right. The killer D's. We got to remember, first of all, that this is the beginning of a kind of funneling process. The caucuses occur every 2 years, every even-numbered election year in Iowa, whether it's a presidential campaign or not. The big publicity with regard to the presidential campaigns was just piggybacked onto pre-existing caucuses. So you have roughly just under 1,700 precincts precincts where they send delegates to the in each party to the 99 county conventions, which then send delegates to the four congressional district conventions, which send delegates ultimately to the state convention in June. And so who's a delegate matters, and they also deal with the question of what do you want to have the party platform say on particular issues in June. So all that's sort of inside party business, but it's democratic, small d, building an organization to make the party stand for something. Now, it's particularly important on the Democratic side this year because, of course, there's the rule, and you know, David Young in some ways owes his nomination to this on the Republican side a couple of terms ago, that if a candidate does not win a primary with at least 35% of the votes to get a nomination, as long as everybody else won less and you got 35 or better, you get the nomination, a plurality nomination, if not a majority, then the party convention or the district convention, the congressional district, depending upon what the office is, they decide who the candidate will be. That's how David Young ended up with the Republican nomination for the 3rd district in, I guess it was 2014. So with so many Democrats running for governor right now, the question is, will we, by the time we reach June, will the field have sorted itself out in such a way that somebody has a plausible chance of it getting at least 35%? If not, then the convention could decide who the party nominee would be, and you want those delegates to favor you. That all starts with the precinct caucuses.
Okay, we don't have much time, but let's no, fine, but we don't have much time. We just want to reference that in talking to Jeff in Iowa City, one of our callers here. We want to make sure you get in here, Jeff, because we know you're on this topic. What do you want to pitch in as we talk about the caucuses?
Well, I think that you're exactly right that these are important because the state convention may nominate the Democrat for governor. But one of the things that IPR is not covering and the Des Moines Register is not covering is that Kathy Glosson had more pledged delegates or committed delegates than any other candidate. That seems to be news, and I think you should report it.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff, in Iowa City. We can report also a new Des Moines Registered Mediacom Iowa poll today. What are the highlights from that? Dennis, have you had a look at that?
Sure. It shows Governor Reynolds, if the election were held right now, roughly, or when they were in the field a week or so ago, that Governor Reynolds would win the governorship, although against any of the particular candidates, the best she scores is around the mid-40s. So she doesn't have a majority yet. So she has work to do. So that shows that she would win, which should be concerning to Democrats. On the other hand, the fact that she's under 50% should help cheer Democrats. But I think the thing I noticed most significantly for Democrats is that it says among Democrats, 81% say they would support Bolton over Reynolds and 76% would back Hubble over Reynolds. That's concerning if 20 to 25% of Democrats might not support one of your nominees. And that's traditionally the problem for Democrats in midterms. They don't show up to vote as regularly as Republicans do.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute or so left. Dave, anything to add to that talk about the governor's race?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the question right now is going to be, can the Democrats unify behind a candidate? And your caller that just came in, Jeff, he brings up Kathy Glasson, who seems to have a tremendous amount of progressive energy behind her candidacy, but she's still not leading the polls, which I think points to the problem the Democrats are facing right now, that the left wing of the party has a lot of energy. Much like in 2010, the right wing of the Republican Party had a lot of energy in the Tea Party movement. The big question is whether that energy is going to be able to nominate a candidate that the rest of the party can get behind. And this far out, it doesn't seem like that's coming together yet. It's going to be really interesting to watch how the Democratic Party moves forward.
So the timeline here as we look forward to the nomination process for the Democrats?
We're heading for the primary in June, beginning of June, and then the state conventions following that in June.
Okay, we do have quite a bit of time as we sit in our February snow till we get to June. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this hour. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. Gentlemen, thanks for getting through the snow and coming to our studios. And we enjoy your analysis, as always. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome.
Tomorrow on the program, I'll talk with a former West Virginia coal miner, Nick Mullins. Mullins will be speaking in Iowa in the next few days. He writes a blog now called The Thoughtful Coal Miner, perhaps breaking some of your conceptions, he would say misconceptions, about what it's like in coal country. Tomorrow, I'll also talk with Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union, about the challenges and concerns of the country's smaller scale farmers, family farmers. Tomorrow, Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union. We hope you'll tune in for that conversation. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. Get in touch with us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.